Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
Private equity is one of these things that a lot of people talk about. It's become a subject of political conversation a lot, and almost nobody understands what it actually is, except for people who work in the industry. An exception to that is Emily Stewart. She's a colleague of mine here at Vox. She's a great reporter. She's up in New York. She understands politics, but she also really understands Wall Street and finance. So she sat down with me, really broke down what this industry is about, why it's controversial, what it does, what kinds of policy changes might help. You're going to learn a lot from this one. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, joined today by Vox.com's own Emily Stewart, who is an author of many fantastic articles, but recently one that I thought was really interesting and will be really interesting to The Weeds audience, and it's about private equity, which is a mysterious but also often discussed concept.
Right. Well, it's sort of a thing that I feel like a lot of people don't know a ton about, but you see enough headlines about it. Like, you maybe don't know what private equity does, but you know that Toys R Us isn't doing too well anymore and not around.
Mm-hmm. Right. And there, I mean, so there's been a few different things, right? It was like, there was like a Taylor Swift private equity controversy to like Elizabeth Warren has like a plan about private equity. And it's often in the mix, right? Of like you may not care about finance, but like if politics, pop culture, retail, it keeps, like, intruding.
Right. I mean, like, I even a couple of months ago was, like, looking for Payless shoes, and then I was like, oh, wait, it doesn't exist anymore. Like, that is because of private equity. And obviously, you see, like, a Taylor Swift, Elizabeth Warren, and, like, what the private equity industry will tell you is that this is a PR problem, but you look a little bit deeper, and it's not exactly true, that this is just, like, we just don't understand how wonderful they are.
Right. I mean, it's a PR problem, but also a reality. This assignment had originated, actually, right, because some editors from the goods vertical, which were interested in sort of retail bankruptcies, right, that sort of famous stores and brands had gone away. And at least some people said that's because of private equity.
Right. Or at least you see, you know, that they're involved. So you have, you know, again, names like Toys R Us, you have Payless Shoes, you have Radio Shack. A lot of retailers have gone under and there have been private equity names in the mix. And so that was sort of how this all began. Plus, then you have Taylor Swift out there talking about Carlyle Group, which is also a big private equity name. And so there's really just been like a moment over the past several months of like, okay, what's going on? What are these people doing?
And so one of the things that I remember from when I wrote Moneybox for Slate and people had questions about hedge funds was that it turns out that there isn't like a super strict definition of like what is a private equity fund, right? Like it's people in the business press like use the term and they have something in mind, but it's not like, you know, like this is a giraffe and that's an elephant.
Right. So, I mean, a lot of times when you talk about private equity, like, it's kind of a nebulous term. So there's also, you know, hedge funds in the mix, venture capital. But a lot of the time what you're hearing about lately, when people are talking about private equity, what they're really talking about are leveraged buyouts, which mm-hmm. is basically, I'm a private equity firm. I buy a company. Like, let's say I buy Toys R Us. But instead of buying 100% of Toys R Us, I kick in 30% of the money. And then the other 70%, I basically acquired through loading up Toys R Us with debt. Mm-hmm. So then it's Toys R Us that owes that money back to creditors. I just owe 30%. And so then what kind of ends up happening is these companies have so much debt that they need to pay back that they can't invest in their business anymore. So, like, yes, has it been hard for retail because of e-commerce? Of course. But if I'm paying all of my money toward this interest that I owe, then I can't make any investments to even attempt to compete.
Right. So let's try to break this down, like how this works, right? I mean, people have loans, student loans often, which are very different from this. But home mortgages are, I think, a sort of relevant analogy, right? Like, very few people have enough money sitting around in the bank to buy a house.
Right.
And what you do is you put, you know, 10 or 20% down, and the rest you get a loan from the bank, and the loan is secured by the house, which means, like, if you don't pay what you owe, like, the bank can take your house because houses are valuable. The bank is willing to lend you at a better interest rate.
Right.
And so a leveraged buyout is like that, but instead of a house, you buy Toys R Us.
Right. But then also the house owes the money and not you when you run out of money. Like, mm-hmm. that is what happens. Like, a house obviously cannot owe money, but Toys R Us owes money. Like, when it's not Toys R Us owes money, but then eventually, you know, it is the employees that lose out. It's the company that eventually, you know, has to kind of disintegrate because the creditors are going to suck out whatever they can when the company goes under.
Right. So it's like Toys R Us, it exists, it has shareholders, and it has some, you know, value, right? Some market capitalization. And then so you, the fund, come to the shareholders, you have, you know, an offer, right?
Yeah.
And you usually have to pay something above the sort of face value. And then you go to a bank or a creditor and you say, okay, Toys R Us shareholders say they will sell me the company if I get $1 billion. If I kick in $200 million, will you lend me $800 million?
Right.
Except it's not going to be me. It's you're going to lend it to Toys R Us.
Exactly. And that's what happens. And then, again, like, if Toys R Us is trying to pay back this money, then it becomes really hard to make any changes to the businesses that they need or, you know, to hire more employees or to try and build up some sort of e-commerce operation. And so eventually they run out of money. And, like, a lot of times, too, like, these companies are already struggling. They're mm-hmm. not doing super well when a private equity firm swoops in. But it a lot of the time they fail. And when they fail really big.
And so when you say not doing well, right, so a situation a company can be in is, like, it's profitable.
Right.
But the market seems to be declining, right? That in particular, right, so it's like more people buy stuff on the internet.
Right.
So the prospects for your store are getting worse. And then it's like the question is, okay, do you do something to, like, try to turn that around? Or do you just continue making money as long as you can, pay a lot of those profits off, and then go bust someday?
Right. And what the private equity industry will tell you is that they're going into things that a lot, they're taking on more risk than maybe, like, others would want to take on, and that sometimes they're going to fail, but they're also giving these companies capital. So, like, if it is a public company that they're reporting their earnings quarter after quarter, they're saying that basically you have a little bit more time if you're private to try and turn things around, and that they're doing the best that they can. And while I was reporting this story out on Toys R Us, one of the things I found was that PBS in 2010 had done a segment on basically why private equity is bad and is hurting people. And one of the examples that they used was Toys R Us, and a lobbying group had written to PBS afterwards telling them that, you know, they weren't as bad as they seemed, that PBS had been unfair, and that one of their success stories at the time was Toys R Us, which had been bought by three private equity firms a few years before. And so obviously, like, at that time, they thought things, like, potentially would go better, uh-huh. but obviously that's not how it worked.
Right. But people, there's a lot of focus gets sort of put on these failures, right? And that can make the whole thing seem very puzzling because, like, obviously, you can't get banks to loan you money just to buy businesses that are going to go bankrupt, right? I mean, so there's a numbers game there, right? So like how does it work? Like, how does this typically make money for the people involved? Because I mean, the Toys R Us story, right, is very sad for the people who work there, right. But also obviously you're hoping, when you lend money to the private equity company, particularly because you don't lend it to the company, right? You lend it to the acquisition target. So you're hoping that you're going to get paid back.
Right. I mean, and I don't want to overstate that private equity fails every time. Like Blackstone not that long ago had helped turn around Hilton for like $14 billion. Like there is money to be made. And obviously, like if there weren't money being made, investors wouldn't be kicking money into private equity firms either. It is like, it's not the worst thing in the world. Again, like I said before, basically the problem is sometimes when it fails big. But also there is an issue of a lot of the time, at least these private equity firms, they're making money anyway. They are charging a 2% management fee a lot of the time to investors. So they're at least making enough money to stay afloat. And then when it does go well, they have to hit some sort of a hurdle rate. So basically, they have to return a certain amount to their shareholders, a certain percentage. But then afterwards, when it goes well, they get 20% of that through carried interest. So there's a lot of money to be made here. And so the risk is worth it to them.
Uh-huh. And they don't hold the sort of most fundamental kinds of risk. I mean, they'll say, well, okay, we have a lot of capital at risk, right? But if you just work someplace, right, and then you lose your job, that's like a – or if you're a town, right, that's like built around a factory and then it closes, that's like a more – it's like a more humanly profound form of risk than like, well, I had a lot of money at stake in this because I'm a rich person who has enough money to have a lot of money at stake in things.
Right. And also like if you are – I mean, I think, again, in the case of Toys R Us, to keep bringing it back to them, but the firms that had invested in that probably made their money back anyway, just because they held on to it for so long and through management fees. But obviously, yeah, like if you are, obviously you're a pension fund or you're an accredited investor, basically, I mean, you're a rich person investing in a private equity firm, you know, investing in a fund, like you have some money that you can lose. And obviously you don't want to lose your money, but it's, like you said, it's not the same as like, well, I don't have a job anymore.
Right. And so we should explain this because from a regulatory standpoint, whether your business model is leveraged buyouts or venture capital investments or hedge fund stuff, what sort of unites these companies is that they raise their money from what's called accredited investors. And what does that mean?
Most of the time, like in layman's terms, that means you're very rich. So to make a little bit more specific, it's either that you have a net worth of $1 million or you make $200,000 annually on your own or $300,000 between you and your partner each year. So you're well off. And basically the point of an accredited investor is to say, you can afford to take some risks and lose money in a way that, like, somebody making $50,000 a year should not be.
Right. So this qualifies you as the fund. If all your money comes from accredited investors, you are put under a much laxer regulatory constraint on the theory that if you just steal these millionaires' monies, like, we don't really care.
Right. And private equity firms will also raise money for funds from, like, pensions or sovereign governments or institutional investors. But basically, they're playing with money that can, like, afford to be lost.
Right. And supposedly, pension funds and things like that have sophisticated managers who know what they're doing. And whether that's actually true or not, I think is a big question, right? I mean, because part of the way these funds make money is they make investments that pay off. But part of it is they charge very high management fees.
Right. I mean, these guys, like, if you're a partner at a private equity firm, you're making money. Like, if you raise, like, a $2 billion fund and you're taking in 2% of that and splitting up amongst the other partners and obviously other fees that you have to pay and taxes and whatever else, that's still a lot of money.
Right. And so, but I think people have raised some pretty big questions as to, like, does this make money for the investors in these funds, actually, right? I mean, obviously, it has at some points paid off, but like on average, are the returns actually worth? Because you pay what, like 20% of the investment gain, and then 2% of the total
Right. Yeah. So you are paying a lot of money, and there is a question, but obviously, like, if you're a pension fund, you're also probably diversified. I mean, hopefully you're a pension fund. If it's not, like, I don't know, call someone to do something. But yeah, I mean, hopefully, like, part of the answer, you know, part of what people will tell you is, like, interest rates are really low right now. So, like, investing in, like, bonds and treasuries is, like, not super high yield, like, things like that. And so basically, a pension fund is kind of like a part, or I'm sorry, a private equity fund is like part of the investment mix right. That a lot of these people are doing.
And in the sort of best version of it, right? I mean, if you're doing private equity PR, you would say, okay, well, we come in, right? We take you, it's called private equity because you go out of the public market. And so now, away from the day-to-day scrutiny of, like, stock market craziness, I can come in with my managerial expertise, mm-hmm. and, like, we make the company better. We're turning these companies around.
Right. And, like, I spoke with Eileen Applebaum, who's an expert on this. She's an economist. And, you know, what she said is the most successful private equity firms and funds are the ones that you never hear about. They're real small. They don't make a lot of noise. So it's not like the Bains. It's not like the KKRs that everybody's heard of. You know, they come in and they have real small expertise. You know, they know a specific niche. They know a specific area. And so, like, yes, like, maybe they know just about biotech or just about healthcare or just about grocery or whatever. And they're just buying really small, like, family businesses that maybe just don't have the expertise to, like, scale up or, like, take the next step in their business. But we don't know what they are because they're not, you know, they're not shouting it from the rooftops. They're not telling anyone. They're just kind of raising their funds as they can and making their money as they can.
So that's sort of like, so Eileen Applebaum, she's like I would say known as a private equity critic.
Yes.
But this is her sort of attempt to give their due to the concept. Right. But she's saying, okay, so, like, a real turnaround shop would be small and focused and, like, we know a lot about whatever, fishing rods.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, a lot of even the bigger firms will tell you that now, like, they're more organized among different industrial verticals so that there is expertise. But there's also a situation, and I found this a lot in reporting on, like, finance and Wall Street, that everybody will say, like, maybe the industry's bad, but they specifically are good. And so, you know, the guys in private equity will tell you that they're good, but really the problem is the bank that's, like, doing the lending. Or the guy at, you know, Blackstone will tell you, like, he's doing the right thing, but, like, the guys over at Bain maybe are not. And so there's also, like, just an awkward, like, and I think that's just human nature, but definitely is a thing that happens.
Okay, let's take a break and then want to talk about some of the specific companies in this mix.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media. Pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context. And it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's NAPP.
This week on The Gray Area, writer Derek Thompson makes his case that everything has become a cult. Well, almost everything.
Is Taylor Swift the closest thing we have to a mass cult today?
No, I think she's the closest thing we have to Christianity.
It's me. Find out if you're in a cult this week on The Gray Area, wherever you get your podcasts.
So you mentioned a few names, Blackstone, Bain, KKR. Bain, I think some people recall from Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. What are the sort of biggest players in this industry?
I mean, those are really the ones that you named that people have probably heard of. So, like, Blackstone is associated with Stephen Schwarzman, who's a big Trump guy. You have Bain, which everybody knows because of Mitt Romney. They were also involved in Toys R Us. Same goes for KKR. Carlyle Group is another big one that was run by David Rubenstein. I think he's still there. I'm not sure.
Maybe.
But so, I mean, there are bigger ones. And a lot, and you know, a lot of these are publicly traded now, which doesn't mean that you're investing in the private equities fund, but you can, like, invest in a stock that tracks how things go for them. But you're not putting your money into, like, the big money fund.
Right, because they then, like, raise funds that do the thing, and it's all. So I think what some people have told me as there's, like, big picture criticism is that really most of this isn't about, like, improving the real operation of the company, but it's, they'll say the phrase financial engineering. Like, what does that mean?
I mean, basically, it's just, like, how do you make as much money out of this as possible? How do you make as much money for your shareholders and for yourself as possible? So whether that's, like, going into a retail chain and saying, okay, like, this store, this model doesn't work anymore, but hey, we have all this real estate we can sell off. Or, you know, spilling up the company in different ways, or, you know, doing basically whatever you can to kind of make enough money and then either be able to sell the company off in parts or sell it off as a whole, you know, wind it down, whatever you need to do, but basically to extract as much out of it as you can.
Right. And this was the sort of, like, selling off of parts of companies was, I think, a big narrative in the 80s. This is... People are fans of Pretty Woman. This is what Richard Gere is doing there. And he supposedly learns that he should seek higher aspirations in business than this kind of thing. Right. But the idea is that, like, a company, it can be, like, more complicated than you might think. Right. So, I mean, one thing I remember is Yahoo. You know, most Americans knew from, like, Yahoo stuff. They had email, they had fantasy football. But Yahoo also had investments in, like, some Asian companies. And those Asian companies had become very valuable. So a lot of the value of Yahoo's stock was bound up in the value of those other companies in a complicated way. And then basically there was just, like, this idea that, like, if you unwound this, it would actually make more money for shareholders, right? So private equity can do a lot of that, right? Like, not analysis of, like, how do you run the business, but analysis of how's the business structured.
Right. And that happens in public markets too. Like, you hear of, you know, companies, like, spinning off, like, a subsidiary, or, I mean, like, if Google could theoretically spin off YouTube, they're not going to, but they could, or if the government could make them. But yeah, so that's sort of what it is. I mean, basically it's just, like, you buy this thing and, like, how can you make money off of it?
Right. And how could you arrange it to be more sort of shareholder optimal? And there's one reason private equity matters is because the threat of takeover impacts how businesses operate when they're not under private equity management. Right. That, like before leveraged buyouts happened routinely, there was, like, one style of running companies, but this is connected with, like, now how public companies are run too.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you're a public company too, you risk, like, an activist investor buying up, like, a part of your company and coming in and saying, all right, you got to do these five things to make me happy. And also, by the way, give me six board seats and, like, get rid of your CEO or whatever they want. Mm-hmm. Like, this is generally how capitalism works. And because, like, we are in a system that we really just value, like, the main point is to make money for your investors and to make money, you know, for your board or whoever else, like, that's just how it is.
Yeah, so activist investors are, I think, sort of conceptually related to this, right? But the difference is an activist investor, I guess, normally doesn't buy the whole company.
Right. They're just investing, like, they'll just buy up, like, a part of a publicly traded company. And it depends on how big the company is, but you can buy, like, 3% and then do that. I mean, a private equity firm really comes in and they buy, like, a big part of it, or sometimes a bunch of private equity firms will buy a company together. And that's called a club deal, where, like, a few of them will pick something up. I think a while back, like, there was some speculation that someone was going to buy Walgreens, and, like, one firm probably isn't going to buy Walgreens, but a few could. But basically, we don't see those deals as much anymore because, like, pension funds will tell you, or anybody who is a private equity investor, you have, like, a less diversified portfolio. So if you have, like, money in, like, KKR and Bain and they both invest in the same company and it goes poorly, you lose money in both.
Right. So that's counterproductive to what the investors, like, wanted.
Right.
I mean, you were saying, like, well, this is capitalism. Like this is how it is. And I think, I mean, I remember when I was talking with Elizabeth Warren and her team about the Accountable Capitalism Act and stuff. And part of their idea is that, well, you know, it's not like America had, like, gone communist in the 50s and 60s, but we didn't have finance playing that same, like, incredibly prominent role in the management of companies, right? So it's like private equity is like capitalism at its most, like, capitalism-y.
Right. And what she and others have proposed is really setting some rules of the road with private equity that doesn't get rid of private equity entirely, but it makes it a lot differently. So basically, if I'm a firm and I invest in a company and it does go bankrupt, I don't get to just walk away and say, well, that's too bad, like that I'm actually on the hook for some of that debt that I've put onto the company, mm-hmm. that I have to do something for the employees who have lost their jobs. How viable is that this is going to become actual legislation,
sure.
is unclear. I was talking to an associate who is at a conference a few months ago, and he had told me that there had been a slide about Elizabeth Warren's plan, and they laughed about the idea that they would be on the hook for debt. So, like, these guys aren't, like, terribly concerned.
But does that mean they laughed because they don't think it'll because they know this can't pass?
Right. They know there's no way. But, like, there could be, like, some more oversight, but there just really isn't. And especially now, like, we have been in this world of, like, shareholder primacy since the 80s, and this is kind of where we are.
And so, I mean, the thing about being on the hook for the debt, right, is that it basically, when companies become more indebted, like, it doesn't have to be private equity to create this situation, right? Like, the management of any company could decide to, and sometimes they do, to, like, take out big loans and then flush out extra cash in a dividend. But they often don't, because it just puts you more at risk.
Right. And like, debt is not bad for companies, especially right now. Like, interest rates are low. Like, if you're any corporation, like, you probably want some debt on your balance sheet. But you don't want so much debt that literally you cannot do anything else but try and pay off your debt. Just like as a normal human being, if I have, you know, tens of thousands of dollars of credit card debt and I can't pay my rent, well, like, there we go.
And in a traditional explanation, right, if I'm trying to do, like, debt 101 and, like, why is it okay to go into debt, I would say, like, well, you know, sometimes a company needs a loan to build a new factory, right? Sometimes you need a loan to go to college, right? And you're investing in the future.
Right.
And the thing about the private equity style debt is that it's not for that purpose, right? It's to make the purchase.
Right. Well, and I was talking to a friend of mine who works for a private equity-focused publication, and he was saying, like, even you see how analyst notes will change. Like, when, I don't know, like, a private equity firm first, like, buys, I don't know, like, an oil company or something, or an oil field, and, like, at first the analysts will be like, yes, like, they have this debt, but they're going to make this much money, so they can definitely pay it off, and also will be, you know, having enough to invest and turn around. And then, like, a year later, the analysts are like, actually, like, they don't have enough money. Like, even that, like, there's this optimism at the beginning, and whether that is because the analysts just don't know what they're talking about or something else is going on. But, like, over time, if you are just kind of, like, constantly on a sinking ship and you can't dig yourself out, then, like, well, you gotta make a change or you gotta shut down.
And this relates to, I think, people's sort of larger perception that, like, what finance is doing is not what we have wanted a financial system to do, or, like, what people would have most traditionally sort of explained, like, you know, yeah, I don't know, you're, like, trying to tell kids, like, why are there banks? Like, what is this for? And you would make a lot of stuff about, like, loans and investments and blah, 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 blah. Whereas this at least seems very abstract.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just hard to tell. I mean, I was talking to a woman who worked for Deadspin, which is the sports website that has basically has not published anything since November. And they were taken over by a private equity firm earlier this year. And she was saying, you know, first they came in and they were telling us they weren't going to touch editorial, but, you know, the business side they were going to turn around and it was going to get better. And then she said, you know, the more that we spoke, the more it was like they had just done no research on what the business was, what worked on the website, what didn't, what got traffic, what didn't. And I think that is sort of an issue that happens with private equity a lot as well, or at least in some people that you've talked to, is that these firms will come in and not really know what they're buying. Like Carlyle Group, which is one of the firms that has funded the record label that Taylor Swift is feuding with. Like, these guys didn't know that they were like walking into some giant fight with Taylor Swift. Like, and that's also part of the problem.
Right. And obviously Vox Media's investors are all
Lovely. Everybody knows.
We'd love
to. Thank you.
You guys are great, but it's the other ones that are bad. And this is something that a long time ago, I think Larry Summers wrote a paper about breach of faith in leveraged buyouts, right? And so one thing that you see, like, in the editorial, right, is that people who work in the media business, I don't know, like, if you look at an employment contract at Vox or anyplace else, it's like, it doesn't say that much. Yeah. It's like, you're going to come here and write some stuff and we're going to pay you some money and whatever. But if you work in the business, like if you work in the industry or if you work at this company, it's like there are tacit understandings of like what are we doing here? Like, right. what is our purpose, right? And like a notion that people are trying to have fulfilling careers, that you wouldn't invest in a company unless you thought you would make money. Right. But you just wouldn't go work in journalism unless you had like a passion for it on some level. And like the bosses, to be effective, need to respect that on some level. But you can come in and like legally speaking, just be like, no, fuck all that.
Right.
Right. And there's like money to be made in the short term by exploiting the gap between like people's tacit understanding of like how life is supposed to work and what your real legal obligations to people are, which there just like aren't a lot.
Right. Well, and it's not like, you know, if I don't know, somebody else buys Vox tomorrow. It's not like I get to walk out the door and be like, oh, I don't know, I don't like you guys anymore. And I definitely have a new job that I can get just tomorrow by like snapping my fingers.
Right.
And so you kind of like, you're stuck in the situation of like, okay, please, like private equity gods or whoever else, like the owners of my business, keep me employed.
Right, right. And it's like, you could draw up a like dumb economics model that's like, well, if the new owners treat the employees poorly, then in a competitive labor market, they'll reallocate to the blah, 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 blah. But like in the real world, it's hard to change jobs.
Right. And I think a lot about the people at Deadspin who kind of resigned en masse like last fall. And like, that is like a great amount of solidarity, but also I cannot imagine how some of them probably would have felt a week or two later being like, holy shit, I just quit my job and the media market is very difficult to find another job in right now.
And when they did it, right, it was like a big story.
Right.
And there was a lot of like supportive tweets and there were takes and stuff. But then, okay, it's 3, 4, 5 weeks later and like the world has moved on.
Right.
To like, you know, snake emoji controversies and whatever else. And like, there you are, right? Like it's a brave thing to do because the downside is very real.
Right. Like in a tweet is not going to like pay my rent or my phone bill or whatever else. That was the things that I owe money to all of the time.
And it's just not a rapidly growing, you know, industry, right? I mean, the good news for like America is that the labor market is a lot better today than it was like 4 or 5 years ago, but it's often not that good, or it's not that good in particular industries or in particular places, and you're kind of stuck.
Right. Well, and like, again, to kind of circle back to private equity, they have, I mean, some of the industries where you know the most of private equity being involved are industries that already are not doing great. So like local media and local journalism, retail, like there's, I mean, it's like, so if you lose your retail job and that's your experience, it's also, well, you're in kind of an industry that's already not doing great.
Yeah, and often the private equity contribution, I mean, I feel like you've really seen this in media, is that instead of it being that the private equity comes in and they, like, help try to turn the company around, it's that the private equity comes in and they are completely unsentimental about the business. And so instead of like putting up the good fight and lasting for 20 years in a declining industry, they're just like, all right, let's like sell off the paperclips.
Right. And, you know, hire, you know, a bunch of 22-year-olds who I can pay zero money to like do some SEO stories and try and game Google and let go of everybody who's been there forever.
Right. But it's like you soak it. It's like you figure no matter what we do, this right. newspaper is doomed.
Yes.
So instead of trying to do our best, yeah. we'll just spend as little as we can, soak the existing subscribers for as long as they're alive and mm-hmm. like walk away. Right. And it's like, a newspaper guy just like wouldn't do that.
Right.
But it takes a private equity person to see it so clearly. And I guess they would say it's good to have capital deployed more efficiently.
Yeah. That is what they would say. Like, I mean, that this is the system that we live in. What are you going to do?
Right. Yeah. So, okay, let's take a break and talk about, I want to talk about big ideas. All right, you tell me you didn't want to talk about neoliberalism, but you just wrote a story about it. And to me, this is like the core of it, right? Not that private equity like owns every company, but that the concept behind private equity, that like companies should be managed more unsentimentally and like just purely with an eye for money for shareholders, like that is at the core of like modern society.
Right. Well, it's just that, like, this idea that, like, of course we have to, like, help poor people sometimes and, like, put up some guardrails for, like, consumers and the environment. But, like, broadly, the markets will compete away problems. And, like, if a business doesn't make sense anymore, well, like, that's just too bad. They couldn't compete. And also, like, businesses will compete away racism because bias is not profitable. Like, that's sort of the broad theory here, if you yeah. were to buy into that.
Yeah, and it's that, like, more efficiency will, like, always be good, right? And the private equity companies, like, that's what they're all about, right? It's like, your company should be running more risks. Like, you should be carrying more debt. Like, you're being too afraid of spectacular failure.
Right, and, like, that... I mean, kind of like, well, the other stakeholders in term like the community or your workers, like we don't care, but also efficiency would theoretically be good for them as well. I mean, it's basically it's just like market efficiency fixes almost everything.
Right. And it's this kind of like utopian idea that well, we're going to have – I mean, I guess the promise of this all, right, going back to the 80s was, well – if you make everything friendlier to investors, there will be more investment, right? And that's going to mean more growth and more jobs and higher wages. And it's all worked out great, right?
I mean, yeah, that's why I have 85 internet bill providers and it's fine. And, like, I don't call to try and talk about my cable bill and they tell me, like, you don't have any other options. Like, of course we have all the options and there's not consolidation. Everything's great. No, I mean, like, obviously, like, it hasn't worked. And maybe it's because we haven't done enforcement around things like antitrust and competition or been taxing people high enough. Like, there are plenty of answers. But I think anybody can, like, look around and not feel like big business or, like, businesses in general have, like, saved our lives.
So, but, like, what would you do, though? I mean, what's a different way of thinking about this? Because, you know, we talked about, you know, Warren's proposal, you know, make the companies sort of hold the risks that they're carrying. But, like, what's a sort of, like, vision behind these kinds of ideas?
So I wrote up this set of papers that came out this week from the Roosevelt Institute, which is a progressive think tank, basically talking about, okay, so, like, if we say that neoliberalism did not work, if we say that the markets have not fixed everything, like, what would work? And they came up with a bunch of different proposals. And, like, just for some examples, you have taking a different approach to antitrust enforcement. Basically, what we've been doing in recent decades is saying as long as prices for consumers are not going up, then it's fine. And what's mm-hmm. happened is, like, a ton of consolidation. So, like, if you think about how many big telecommunications companies there are not that many. And Sprint and T-Mobile are about to merge.
Yeah.
If you think about, I mean, basically just anywhere in your life. Seems like there's a few big brands. So, like, that's a problem. Or, you know, like, we have this sort of sense that, like, competition among businesses will, you know, just kind of, like, make prices lower. But, like, if you look at health insurance, clearly your health insurance bill is not super cheap. So, like, what if you had, a public option for health insurance? But you could also do a public option for plenty of other things. So basically saying the government can compete against business itself.
Some of this has to do fundamentally, though, with sort of treatment of workers, right? That, I mean, I think a lot of the private equity pushback comes from out of the labor union space. And the sense is that, you know, a sort of relentless focus on profitability and capital return is, like, inherently bad for people's working conditions.
Well, yeah, because if your company wants to pay its shareholders and it doesn't want to pay you, like, every dollar that it's not paying, you know, every dollar it's paying you is money it's not going to its investors. And so, I mean, I think, you know, at Vox, we just unionized, and that is, like, exciting for us. And I think that's why you see a lot of people, like, now talking about, like, a rebirth of unions a little bit more and giving workers more power to negotiate and to say, like, hey, you have to, like, pay attention to us in this broad scheme of, like, all of these stakeholders that businesses have to deal with.
And this is interesting because, you know, I mean, I always remember vividly when I was sort of new in D.C. and I was having a conversation with a guy who, you know, went on to be a very influential economic policymaker in the Obama administration. And I was saying something to him and he was like, well, what you have to understand is that, like, the labor share of national income is just the same all the time. And we can't actually impact that. And that's a very, I mean, that's like a nerdy, you know, it's sort of an obscure point, but it's a profound idea, right? Like, if you believe that is true, then unions and everything else are just kind of pushing money around from one group of workers to another. But I think it now looks to more people like, no, right? That, like, there's a struggle, like, between workers and owners for money, and that private equity is, like, a powerful contender in that struggle.
Right. Or if you have, I mean, this is not the case in private equity, but if you were to have workers at the table in boardrooms, like, making decisions, they would probably make different decisions for the businesses than if it is just a board of directors, like, at any typical American corporation. So, yeah. I mean, workers will obviously, like, if I have to make a different decision between, like, if I get a dollar or whoever has invested in Vox gets dollar, like, I want the dollar.
And, I mean, the studies I've seen of sort of co-determination in Germany, so that, like, when workers get voices at companies, they're managed more conservatively, right? So it's the opposite of the, like, debt load thing. Because actual people who work someplace, I mean, they like money, but they also, like, put a premium on, like, right, let's not all lose our jobs, right? If you're an investor, you can be more, like, quote-unquote objective about the risk or see it purely financially. But, like, there are more dimensions to life than that.
Right. I mean, like, there's also a world where you, I mean, like, yes, it's more conservative. Like, a worker would maybe run the company more conservatively, but they're also thinking a lot longer term, maybe.
Right.
Like, maybe the business would be around in 5 years versus if, like, investor is just thinking about, you know, making whatever return he or she wants.
And that's the difference between, like, money and people, right? Because if you're a dollar and you're like, well, okay, I've got $10 and they're spread across 10 companies, and if two of them go bankrupt but others are profitable, then, like, I'm doing fine. Like, what's right. the difference? One company's in, one company's out. But if it's your life, right? I don't know. It's like if, like, journalism went away. Like, we'd maybe get jobs doing something else.
Yeah.
But, like, I'd be sad.
Yeah. And, like, I mean, like, I don't know what my job would be.
Right.
I don't know. It's not like I'm going to go be an engineer, but maybe I should have been. I don't know.
I mean, it would be very alarming, right? Like, it would be terrifying. Like, you've lost your job. Like, what if you have to move? Like, what if you have to eat?
Right.
Right? It's, like, stressful. There's all kinds of non, like we work in part because we get paid.
Right.
But there's, like, more to it than that to us. And right. there's nothing more to it to, like, the sort of investment zone.
Right. Well, that's, like, I mean, again, like, that's what capitalism is, basically, like, in a nutshell. I don't know, like, yeah, like it basically, like it's just, I don't know how to even put it.
It's capitalism. It's yeah. It's rule by capital.
Yeah.
Right. Which is what it is. So you were telling me that you got some feedback on your article. And people said that you were making them sad.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So, like, two types of feedback. Some that made me sad. Like, I did hear from people writing and saying, like, I lost my job at, like, this grocery store. Or I lost my job to a private equity firm, which was, like, really hard to hear. And then I did have a lot of, you know, guys working in private equity saying, like, we feel like we are good and we do help and there is a lot of upside. And, like, I'm not saying there's not upside. Like, clearly, if there were not, there would not be billions of dollars in this industry. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I hear that. I know that they, I mean, like, and I'm not saying, like, it's the end of the world, like, that they are all the worst people in the world. And like, what they will tell you, like, anybody in the industry will tell you, like, we are trying our best to make money. We are often taking on risk that no one else wants to take on. And, like, we are hoping that things go well. And when they do not, that it's not our fault. And you hear about them because a lot of times when they go wrong in a very big way.
But it is, to me, one of the weirder things about finance is that these are very well-paid jobs. But the people who have them seem to also, like, really want everyone to like them.
Right. But also, I mean, like, to be honest, like, in, like, who probably gets the last laugh here of, like, me working in journalism or, like, 25-year-old guy working in private equity? It's, like, probably him, like, in terms of, like, finance, right?
Right.
But, yeah, like, they, I mean, again, like, everybody wants to feel like they are doing a good, or they want to say that they feel like they're doing a good thing. I don't know. Like, if you bankrupt a company and you lay off a bunch of people, I don't know that, like, even, like, in the rosiest of ways of thinking about what happened, like, you would feel good about that. But what they will tell you is that it is not intentional and that they go in with good intentions every mm-hmm. single time.
Right. But, I mean, I do think, I mean, if we have finance guys here in the audience, it's like, you should think about it. Because, like, really, the purpose of the industry is to say that, well, you need to take these structures and, like, optimize them more for the interests of their equity owners. And, like, is that a good thing, right? Or, like, is what you're doing, like, compromising the non-financial benefits of important social institutions, you know, for personal gain? Because that's what it looks to me like they're doing. And, you know, it's not the worst thing in the world. It's not the same as, say, just, like, killing people to take their money. But, like, it's really not great.
Right. And, like, you know, sometimes, like, they really, maybe they do turn the business around. They do create more jobs. Like, I've seen some research that says when it's a private-to-private deal with private equity, like, they will create jobs. But when it's a public-to-private, they do not create jobs. And in the meantime, like, what does any of this mean for anybody if you lose your job tomorrow? Like, it's just, it depends on how you define optimize. Like, are you optimizing it for who? Like, are you optimizing it for, like, this rich guy who already has $1 million in the bank, or, like, the person making $10 an hour on the sales floor?
And it also just seems so antithetical to, like, a traditional model of, like, what is business? Like, right. You're not inventing anything. You're not building anything. Really, you're just kind of screwing around with other people's operations. I mean, maybe that's unfair, but, like, maybe it isn't, right? Like, if you're buying up, you know, distressed newspaper assets and then just coming up with ways to fire people, like, that's really different from, like, starting a visionary media company that you think will succeed. And, like, you can say you have good intentions, but it's hard for me to see the good intentions.
Yeah, and you know, if, again, like, these companies have all of this debt all of a sudden, like, I think it's sometimes hard to make an argument that you're trying to invest in the long term when, like, all they're investing in is paying off their interest payments plus dividends sometimes to the managers. Like, if I can't, like, even try to improve my business, like, how can you say that this is, like, a positive situation?
Right. And it's, like, the positive would have to be that the, like, global efficiency of capital allocation is going to help someone somewhere. And I don't know. It seems kind of dubious.
Yeah, I don't know. This whole thing. It was really, like, fun to learn about and report out and be like, yay, Taylor Swift and Elizabeth Warren. And now it's just like, well, I don't, I mean, like, again, like, with all of the people who have felt like this has been unfairly portrayed, it's like, ultimately, like, you guys got a lot of money in the bank and all these Toys R Us employees that don't have jobs do not. So I don't know.
So with that cheery thought, thank you so much, Emily. You know, any angry finance guys out there, come to the Weeds Facebook group and let us know about the incredible things you are doing in the world of equity allocation. So thanks so much. It was really interesting. It was a great topic to take on. Thanks to Malachi Brodus, our engineer, Jackson Bierfeldt, our producer, and the Weeds will be back on Tuesday.